This episode is sponsored by ABI Interiors, an Australian-designed fixtures supplier specialising in high-quality kitchen and bathroom products for the modern home. ABI Interiors will turn your dream home into reality with a timeless product range that includes stylish tapware, basins, sinks, baths and showers in up to 7 signature finishes. You can visit the ABI Interior Showroom at Design Centre Chelsea Harbour or shop online at abiinteriors.co.uk.
You do get shaped by the existence that you live in. There's something so remarkable about coming home and walking into a space that nurtures you. And I love that. I really love that. I try and create that within, you know, my clients' environments.
Welcome to a new series of House Guest with me, Carol Annett, interiors editor of Country and Townhouse magazine. Here I talk to the creatives who shape the world around us through design and decoration. My first guest is British designer Tim Gosling. After an early career in theatre, Tim worked alongside the late Princess Margaret's son, David Linley, before launching his own eponymous studio. His world is steeped in history, curiosity and creativity, and he has some wonderful stories of working with other brilliant people from the world of music, fashion and perfumery. Today I am sitting with the gorgeous Tim Gosling.
Hooray!
Hooray! In his house in Clapham, which is something to behold, an 18th century mansion, but you bought the flat. You bought it as a flat originally.
Exactly.
Anyway, I'm going to come on to that.
No, no, no.
Because I need to say that Tim is an internationally renowned for his ability to reimagine and enhance environments, creating interiors and beautifully crafted furniture using traditional techniques.
Oh, thank you.
Absolute pleasure. And it's lovely to see you. And it's always a pleasure to come here. So tell me a little bit about your own home.
So Sycamore House is a fantastic building that was created in 1787. And the exciting thing about this, the ability to try and find it, was dictated by a painting that I had. So I literally started off with saying, great, I have a painting this big and I don't mind where it is that I find a place in London, but it's got to fit. And they went, oh, gosh. And so the first time I saw this, this was already under offer, and they were kind of writing it all up. And they showed me the next door apartment. And I said, gosh, that's really sweet of you, but actually I'd like this one. They said, well, it's sold. I said, well, how sold? And so I just offered another £1,000 every single day for 2 weeks. And eventually they cracked and they said, okay. So it was really naughty, but I desperately wanted this because it's got the most amazing, you know, ceilings and original cornice and all of the work that Adam was kind of creating for the great stately homes had, you know, trickled down into the domestic houses. And this would have been in the countryside in Clapham at that point. And to have something like that to play around with was just so exciting. That was, for me, great.
This is what I love about you and your passion for design. And you sort of put your eye on something and you have to have it. And that's what's the loveliness about this world. There's no logic to it. It's just
no,
it's
a madness.
It is a madness.
And I think that that's what's gorgeous about being creative and trying to make a space, a home and a teaching tool and it kind of, you know, Churchill was the first one that said, you know, we shape our buildings and then the buildings shape us. And I think, you know, that's something that resonates every single time I think about creating architecture and creating furniture design and interiors, because you do get shaped by the existence that you live in. And I think that, you know, you mentally get shaped by it. There's something so remarkable about coming home and walking into a space that nurtures you. And I love that. I really love that. I try and create that within, you know, my clients' environments.
And your clients, of which you have had an extraordinary list of A-list celebrities, including Elton John.
I mean, I've been incredibly lucky to kind of grow up with so many people, Elton being one of them. Elton and David are, you know, are incredibly great friends of mine. But it's also, you just know them as people and you love them because, you know, Elton's, again, another incredible mind where I've learned so much from him in terms of the things that he collects. So he was the first person that has started collecting contemporary glass. And so for the house in the south of France, this thing arrived and from a guy called Chihuly, who I'd never even heard of. And, you know, we were designing some things underneath it. And then I said, so where does it turn on? And he went, oh, it doesn't. It's just, you know, it's glass. And I went, I don't understand. It's a chandelier and it's got no lights. So, you know, and he was so far ahead of his time. So, you know, he collected the most remarkable amount of contemporary glass. In fact, actually, I think he's got a sale of some of the stuff that's coming up from the Atlanta apartments that he has. And what's interesting about that is that, you know, when he changes a kind of tact and then starts collecting something else, including, you know, early photography, my goodness, you know, he then becomes an expert on it. Like no one else. I mean, it's just, and puts together a collection that just blows your head off. And I think that's, you know, we share that same passion. And I've been lucky enough to meet so many people like Elton or people like Joe Malone, where, you know, I don't know very much about perfume. And suddenly you've got Joe saying, well, you know, the scents are rather like, you've got to think of it in terms of music and how the music notes change depending on the temperature of your skin. And so therefore, when you talk about French perfume, how all those notes are different because they interact with your own tones that become unique to you. And so you've got these people that are suddenly in your life that become people that, you know, everyone refers to them as celebrities or A-listers, but it's just they're doing the best of whatever, you know, genre that they're in. And you suddenly go, gosh... Gosh, I love Paul Smith. Yeah, he used to make our suits for us when we were so young that we just desperately wanted to look grown up. And so Paul and Jonathan used to come over and see David and I, and it was just hysterical because you just think, I can't believe that that was how it was. And so, you know, growing up in a world in which all these people shape our world, and I'm lucky enough to have that relationship and to be shaped by them as well.
Please tell me that Elton has a man cave.
Several in different countries.
Good. Okay, we can move on now. I want to know what it is that you love most about the design process, because I know that you're an extraordinary draftsman and drawing was very much, that's how you got into design in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was very, very lucky that I loved theatre and I was a dreadful actor. And so therefore...
I've seen you in pantomime, Tim.
That's, having no fear is very different. I mean, the gorgeous thing about, you know, so going into theatre design was a specific kind of route that I just loved everything to do with, you know, drama, creation of a space. And the training for doing theatre design at that point in the 1980s was remarkable. There were only 18 people in our year. So the
what
one...
What year are we talking about?
So this, I think we're kind of about 1981, 82, 83. You know, at the Central St. Martin's, you know, over in Holborn, it was a remarkable place to be trained because it was so intense. And, you know, that really knocked me into shape. Up until that point, you know, I loved art. I could draw, you know, but badly. And
well, you got into art school off the back of your but that portfolio.
But that was only because I put into the portfolio all the... So I should kind of step back and say that my father, who's a mad scientist, had from the age of 8 to when I was 35, taken us to nudist colonies in the south of France. And so when I'm stuck...
As you do.
And when there's nothing to draw in terms of architecture, I just drew naked people because there was nothing else to draw and I couldn't help drawing. So for going for the interview for art school, the only thing that I had left in my portfolio was kind of what they term as life drawing, but it wasn't, it was just the beach in the south of France. And my parents were horrified. I went, look, I've got to take something because I've got nothing else to take. And that is the only reason that I got into art school. Because, you know, it's so unusual for someone at 18 to have so much life drawing because they don't teach it at school. And for theatre, life drawing and the ability to put a person in a space is critical. And so therefore that leads on to costume design. It leads on to so many different aspects. And for me, it then was a, you know, I came out of art school and then did Miss Saigon straight away for 2 years, which was doing the set design.
Okay.
So working with John Napier and playing with the helicopter, which is basically the largest Flymo known to man.
I remember
incredible.
That.
And I found all the drawings last week. My mother was kind of cleaning out the loft and there are all my original drawings from Miss Saigon. I'm just thinking, oh my goodness, that's such a long time ago now.
And that was a groundbreaking piece of theatre because of all the technology.
Completely.
Yeah.
And actually, I think that it had got to the stage when it was still theatre production with the backing of technology. And it moved another couple of years and it then became so technical that actually if the actors didn't turn up, it didn't really matter.
Yeah.
And, you know, people wanted something spectacular. But then it was really interesting because then having met David Linley and I started kind of working with David, doing all kinds of things to do with the furniture design, I very quickly realized that the idea of interiors or furniture design or the essence of something, it's all theater. I mean, you're creating a sense of space by disseminating the essence of something. And, you know, going back to understanding what you're looking at and understanding what you're seeing gives you that ability, not only to create it, but to buy things at auction, to understand the period that it's from. You have this gut reaction of knowing whether it's right or whether it's wrong. And that's really fascinating.
Is it safe to say that you are an auction addict?
Yes, I think there is no question. I mean, my fiancé is Steve. It's very weird to say fiancé, but we're getting married this September, which is so exciting. Hooray. We're literally like feeders with each other. You go, oh, I've seen this desk. You go, oh, no, now you've shown it to me. I've got to get it. So we're restoring a place in France, in Normandy at the moment.
Not just a place.
Okay, it's a large chateau. Well, I keep on saying it's kind of, it's 57 rooms, so it's gigantic. And we keep on telling ourselves it's not that big because I think that calms us down a bit. But it means there's a lot of purchasing of a lot of pieces. And that's really exciting because putting together the state rooms again, and, you know, the family's been amazing at giving us the photographs, and we've got all the original invoices for all the pieces, and some of the furniture, the original furniture is coming back to the chateau, and the original sculpture and paintings, and it's just, I mean, that's a full-time, you know, that's a team's full-time job, actually.
Yeah.
So we do spend a lot of time looking at auctions, and every single week something arrives from somewhere around the world.
And presumably it's very important to know what you're buying, what you're looking at. Are there any sort of safeguards? I mean, do you go with your gut? I mean, you've obviously been in the trade for a long time. So, but I mean, should one fall in love with something because of how it looks and then you start looking into its provenance? Yeah. I mean, are there some rules and regs? Or by the time it's got to auction, it's kind of should be okay?
No, I mean, I think there's some things that kind of, you know, go through auction and they're catalogued badly, or yeah, you really have to look at the photograph. So you having a good photograph of it, if you can, you've got to see it, because, you know, seeing a piece really does make you understand what you're looking at, and you just see instantly whether the gilding's original, whether it's not original, what's happened to the piece is literally just like, you know, its dossier is in front of you visually. The most important thing if you're just buying from a photograph is to check the measurements. That's the 101 of auction, is to get a tape measure out and actually put it out, you know, get the tape measure out and just hold it in front of you so you can visually, as if you're imagining seeing it, because photographs on our phones or our iPads or, you know, computers are all the same size. And you can look at a tiny little portrait and it's the same size as it would be a kind of, you know, 9-foot painting. So really understand the scale. And that leads you on to another thing, which is for me and Steve, the most important thing about buying for the chateau is scale.
Yeah.
Because you put something that's normal size into the space and you just go, oh gosh, that's really not going to work. It's completely overwhelmed. It's lost. So it needs to be double to triple the size of anything. You've got kind of 4.2 meter ceilings in kind of ground floor staterooms. And that just requires you to supersize everything. And then it still just looks normal.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre. So, you know, and sometimes we've bought things that are completely scale right for the chateau and they arrive here. They can fit through the door into here, into the hall, and they can't get any further. So there are moments when you go, oh gosh, I can't even turn it round.
And I love it, for every time I come here, there's always something new to look at. So you've just bought, I mean, I would call it a half tester, but is that, that's the crown kind of bed.
So they call it a corona. So
a crown.
Yeah. So the crowns for beds, and, you know, some during the 18th century, they were actually crowns and they were round. And then you took the design of the fabric straight down from it. And as they got into the 19th century, they became slightly wider as the beds got wider. I mean, French beds generally are kind of slightly narrower than our normal beds here. And it's interesting because it still confuses me that we still have, you know, different sizing for beds in America versus Paris and France and in England. And so the furniture also then for beds and various different things is also slightly kind of mismatched.
That's, yeah, that's quite confusing, isn't it?
Really confusing.
Maybe the French are better at snuggling together.
I think, well, you know, it's interesting because if you kind of take it to a fantastic cock-up in the kind of reign of Charles I, which is the Banqueting House, which is one of my favourite buildings because it's the first classical building to be built in England in 1619. And it's on Whitehall, it's where kind of Charles I was executed. From the window. But what's amazing is he commissioned Rubens to do the ceiling, which was the biggest cock-up known to man because the ceiling arrived and the French foot measurement is different from the English foot.
No.
And it didn't fit. I mean, seriously. So they ended up to kind of... So when you look at the painting of the ceiling, which is remarkable, there are kind of figures that are kind of chopped off. And, you know, because the French foot was larger than the English foot. It's just
because they didn't get the measuring tape out.
Well, no, because... I love that you have two different systems. You have the French foot is a different size to the English foot.
And ours is obviously correct.
And so therefore, I think there's this that ricochet of different sizes for different things and, it goes back through history and it's always been a kind of, you know, monumental screw up. What's amazing is you still get the same kind of concept of the problems with gauges of railways, which is half the problem of not being able to get a steam train going from here to, you know, the continent because the gauges of tracks were different. And I think you just assume that everything is universal because we live in a global world now and everything wasn't. And it just became more and more complicated to interlock all of that.
Obviously, your heart is very much in sort of traditional,
rooted in history.
Rooted in history. Yeah. Thank you. That's a much better way of saying it. But I also wanted to chat about using different materials like carbon fiber. So there's a very modern element to what you do as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what's so fantastic about the things that we're lucky enough to create at the moment. So they're all rooted in history and some of them are staggeringly contemporary. And we do a massive collection of carbon fiber super yacht furniture, which is really beautiful. And that was kind of rooted design-wise in the kind of 1920s and 30s luxury travel. However, you're using the idea of carbon fiber in this country. We are the most extraordinary at leading the technical ability from Formula One and from the Red Bull teams. And so subsequently, we've got this incredible material we can then play with, which allows you to do things visually that you couldn't do with other materials. So we can create pieces that can fold in half with sun loungers that, you know, then can lie outside and, you know, they won't rot, they won't fall to bits.
And is it very light?
It's really light. So you have to kind of almost reverse engineer it to be able to make it heavy enough so it doesn't blow off the deck.
Yeah.
But it means that it just won't change. You know, it's carbon fiber basically goes through a whole molecular change. When you put it under high pressure and heat, it changes its molecular structure. So it basically is a kind of carbon weave, which is black. And you can interlace it with different colours, but it's going to be predominantly black. And then that gives you a strength of a material that's harder than steel.
And so furniture that you have designed for super yachts, you've been using
carbon fibre.
Starting to use carbon fibre.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for me, it's really exciting when you come across new materials. So that is one of them, which is fantastic. And there's another new material, which is graphene, which was invented by the University of Manchester. And it's quite difficult to describe. And I've sat through a few lectures and seminars on it, and I'm still not 100% how you end up with a compound that it's basically one atom thick. So it's even stronger than carbon fiber, which allows you to be flexible. So you can create a dining room table 3 meters long with kind of legs at one end and legs at the other end. And it's just so thin, but it's absolutely just rock solid. You could tap dance on it. So just work
in heels.
In heels. In for pantomime. I should explain that for everyone because they're going, I don't understand what's going on. Yeah, so it's incredible when you can add that to paint. So I did a kind of range of things with graphene stone, which was really interesting because their whole product was based on the use of graphene. And it has a binding agent, which gives it strength. So it's incredibly hard wearing. But then also as it dries, it allows the CO2 to be absorbed in it.
And so you have a collection, the restoration paint collection with graphene stone,
yeah,
which you have
done with the chateau.
Done with the chateau in mind, with the colours that you use in the chateau.
Because we just couldn't find any colours at all that were 18th
actually,
century.
It's, the colours are quite rich and bold.
Yeah, I mean, I think that colour is a fascinating subject. I mean, and we could talk for hours and hours and hours on that, because it's just, you know, you can't help seeing colour through the lens of the time in which you're living.
Yeah.
And I think that it's really dangerous to say that that's an absolutely accurate historic colour, because it changes so much. You know, even you look at the Soane Museum, which has the most wonderful red dining room. John Soane came back from Italy on his only trip with a piece of tassel saying, this is Roman red. Well, the Romans would have no idea what they're looking at, because that was baked under the pyroclastic flow and has darkened so dramatically compared to the red that it would have been, as the Romans would have recognised. And I think there's a danger in saying that's absolutely accurate. What you can understand is the drama that something creates historically, and try and understand the compounds of how it was created. So creating, you know, a yellow in Regency time was almost impossible. They've just invented a brand new blue. I think it was about 5 or 6 years ago in Utah, in America. And that's very distinctly different. So when you look at it, you go, gosh, I've never seen that blue before. So it's not often that a new colour comes along that you haven't seen. But, you know, historically that was happening when people were able to fix the colours and create these things out of the natural world around them.
I love the idea that your father was this incredible scientist. Did he discover DNA? Or he took the first image of DNA?
So he was part of the team. So he took the first photograph of DNA, which is photograph 51, which is the 51st photograph of trying to get it right. And with Rosalind Franklin, and incredible to be part of the whole discovery of that. And then it's an amazing story that Watson and Crick then started working on a model of it, having seen the photograph, because, you know, there were two teams. There were, you know, obviously London University, which is now, you know, connected to Somerset House and King's. And that's where my father and Rosalind were based. And then obviously up in Cambridge, you have Watson and Crick. So this race between the kind of two starts. And it's a fascinating story to see and to kind of witness.
But also, it seems that you've gone down an entirely different route. But actually, there's so much science.
There's so much science in design.
What you are involved in.
Yeah, and also, you know, creativity. And I was always terrified about numbers and maths because I didn't understand it. And it didn't really have a kind of a connection to the world that I was inhabiting. But as I've got older, you know, the more I experience with playing the piano and music, it is pure maths. The more I understand about design, again, you know, it's, you know, you look at Art Deco and the division of three or five becomes your rhythm of maths to do with the visual aspects of what you're looking at. Proportion-wise, you know, it's all maths. And so I've stopped being scared about that anymore, and I've really embraced that. And that's a gorgeous thing to feel, that sense of being able to understand something. There's the last book I did, which was with Thames and Hudson, I called The DNA of Furniture Design, which slightly irritated my father because he says, well, it's not strictly about structure, is it? It's not actual DNA itself. It's DNA. And I said, well, now that's become a, you know, an ability to talk about, you know, the idea of something's essence. Well, it's not strictly true. And so you'd have this one talk. But it's really interesting when you watch those two worlds collide. And, you know, the more you drill down into anything that's, you know, that's spiritual or the sense of yourself, it becomes closer to quantum physics. The idea of the kind of, you know, the quantum leap. So two things can exist in the same space in two different locations, which is when you start talking about your sense of soul or spirit, that's exactly the same thought process.
I love all that. We're getting very deep. So I'm going to lighten the mood, Tim. I want to know where you're getting married. Are you getting married at the Chateau?
We tried to get married at the Chateau, but again, I think the problem with that is that, you know, being a Catholic country, we would burst into flames and it would be kind of slightly complicated.
Oh, yeah, that's not ideal.
Kind of one. So we really tried. And I particularly wanted, you know, we talked about this a lot, to find a sacred space that we could get married in. And so, you know, after a lot of discussions, we've been very, very kindly let, you know, we're going to get married in St. Martin's in the Fields, which will be brilliant because it's the first church that Steve went to after coming from Australia to London. And I spend my life musically there. And, you know, it has a massive part of my kind of life, that whole area. So that's going to be great. In fact, actually, we chose the music, been working with a whole group of people to work out the music. So I'm trying not to turn it into a concert, but it's just, you know, music is so important for me and for Steve. So, yeah.
Ah, wonderful. And if there was, I mean, you've worked with incredible people, Elton and David, Joe Malone, Paul Smith. Is there anyone that you feel that even in the past, not with us anymore, that you would love to have been a part of creating a home for them?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think...
Marie Antoinette or something.
Yes, I mean, I think that some of the... I would love to have met Louis XIV. I think that he would have been a fascinating person to get your head round. And I think that one of the biggest privileges of my life is spending time with the Queen Mother and talking about her palaces and how they were run and her relationship with understanding things that have completely disappeared in her lifetime. I'm coming back from St. Petersburg when I was blown away by the museums and the kind of, you know, and she said, but gosh, you know, we were having dinner and she said that she knew the Tsar quite well. And I was like, gosh, that's remarkable. He said, in fact, he gave me my first piece of Fabergé. Would you like to see the collection? And I said, you know, literally my eyes popped out. But to be shown, you know, the pieces of Fabergé that she was given by the Tsar and to talk about the way that they were palaces still in her head because she had visited them as a child. And so that's quite incredible. So you have these cornerstones of history where someone's able to, you know, explain the thought process of what that is to you.
And did you work with the Queen Mother on any of her residences?
Yeah, so Dave and I are going to do some gorgeous things for Clarence House, which is still there in the new incarnations that King Charles and Camilla have. So, yeah.
And actually, what I love today is that we were flicking through the crown,
the
sale of the pieces in the crown, and you're trying desperately not to buy a state crown. I can't wait to see what you're going to come away with.
It's incredible when you look at some of the things that were created for it. And, you know, again, that's kind of theatre but on film, and it's really interesting to see. But, yes, you know, Steve and I did say, gosh, how about a state carriage? Just a little for the chateau. In fact, actually, the great thing is that we've got two or three of the carriages, you know, still completely just covered in cobwebs from the chateau that are in a kind of barn at the top. So,
well, there you go. You've got one already. You don't need
I know. That. It's just, gosh, then it's the horses. Then it's, you know.
You can take the state carriage off the list.
Yeah.
Tim, it's always a joy to speak to you. Thank you so much and for being so welcoming into your home.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for joining me today. You can hear more Houseguest on British Airways In-Flight Entertainment in the audio section, along with our sister podcast, Breakout Culture, with Lord Ed Vasey and Charlotte Metcalf. You can follow me on Instagram at Carol W. Annett.